we grasp for what we might get and fail to grasp what we might give up. For better and worse, regulators in some countries are already moving in to protect backers from unscrupulous crowdfunding campaigns. Better if they protect us from fraud, but perhaps worse if they squash the risk-taking at the heart of many of the ventures being funded. Kickstarter describes the riskiness inherent in its projects as a feature, not a bug. Implication number 2. Viral does not equal vital. In July of 2013, our 4-year-old daughter Eliza was diagnosed with a rare terminal genetic disease called Sanfilippo Syndrome Type A. The GoFundMe campaign began. In one terrifying instant, we were told that we would have to watch her fade away before our eyes. This bleak story came with a silver lining of hope. Researchers at the Nationwide Children's Hospital had developed a breakthrough gene therapy treatment for Sanfilippo syndrome, and with just $2 million, could run a clinical trial. Eliza's parents, Glenn and Cara O'Neill, set $2 million as the target for their campaign, more than anything GoFundMe had previously been used to raise. Initial progress was slow. They found it hard to get beyond their own social networks. In desperation one night, Glenn frantically Googled how to make a viral video and found his way to Benjamin Von Wong, a young videographer. Wong and his colleagues dropped everything and flew to Columbia, South Carolina, to stay with the O'Neills for 8 days. Together, they created a heart-wrenching short video about Eliza, told through the distraught voices of her parents. Hope is a nice word, but we need action, Cara says, appealing to our sense of urgency. It was emotional storytelling, befitting its subject matter, with slow-motion footage of Eliza just being a normal, beautiful kid. The video was the breakthrough the O'Neills needed. It got the attention of mainstream news outlets, attracted 600,000 views on YouTube, and massively boosted donations. Toward the end of 2015, when the O'Neills were close to reaching their at-first improbable $2 million goal, a wealthy Texan businessman came on board, pledging to match all donations from that point onward. In May 2016, Eliza was the first child in the world to be given the experimental treatment the campaign had funded. Eliza's is a crowdfunding success story if ever there was one. A rare disease that was too small and marginal to attract institutional funding finds resources from the generosity of tens of thousands of small contributors, each now invested in Eliza's story. What's not to celebrate? However, while individual stories of success lift our hearts, the aggregate picture that emerges from the many cases of new power funding is more complicated. At Davos in 2016, an installation full of innovation buzzwords offered what at first glance seemed to be a new and exciting possibility. What if public infrastructure was funded by the crowd? Harvard Law Professor Jonathan Zittrain took a photo of the installation and added the caption, or as some would call it, taxes. In an old power world, he reminded us, many of the things that are now being disaggregated and crowd-funded were centralized. We paid our taxes and asked governments to make rational decisions balancing society's different needs and priorities. Taxes are the antithesis of crowdfunding. We get almost no agency in deciding how funds are spent, other than a vote every few years to pick the government that makes those decisions. We get no feedback loops that give us the visceral, rewarding sense of having been part of building something. We have no personal connection to an individual story or challenge. It's no surprise, given the deeply unrewarding user experience of being a taxpayer, that people feel increasingly skeptical of and remote from government. But let's imagine that a town did crowdfund its infrastructure spending, rather than rely on the centralizing mechanism of taxpayer-funded government. Chances are that the most interesting public infrastructure projects with the best stories would attract the most buzz and dollars. The awesome solar-powered underground farmers market would almost certainly play better than the vital but deeply unsexy project to smooth out the gravel on the local highway. Environmentalists have known this slightly depressing fact for years. When groups like the World Wildlife Fund raise money from the crowd, they rely almost exclusively on what the sector calls charismatic megafauna. Save the Panda Bear will always beat presenting the strategic plan to conserve the mountainous regions in central China where pandas live. As crowdfunding models proliferate in areas that used to be considered public goods, like education, a debate is brewing. Is crowdfunding for things like textbooks helping kids, or actually hurting public education by taking the heat off government? GoFundMe has become the biggest crowdfunding site in the United States, in large part because it has become a way for people in distress to raise money for their own basic healthcare, something that is state-provided in many other countries. Crowdfunding may also act to reinforce privilege. Eliza O'Neill had a father savvy enough to get a viral video made about his daughter and a mother who, as a pediatrician, had the skills and know-how to navigate the healthcare system. For every true outsider story in this new, disaggregated world, we often see the already powerful proving to be the most capable of whipping up the support of the crowd. Though there is no question that crowdfunding has opened access greatly for people to run their own initiatives and put them to market, it currently lacks any mechanism to ensure that its benefits are evenly shared or efficiently allocated. Life in 2946, the future of funding. For superfan Nekara, engagement on Reddit deepened his connection with Star Citizen. As a self-appointed Star Citizen ambassador and recruiter, he had been writing long Reddit posts to help people understand the game. Through these posts, he met and teamed up with another citizen. They decided to found a media company. 3 days later, they launched the Imperial News Network with the mission to bring the verse to life and cover all manner of Star Citizen-related news and discussion. It became a popular hub for other citizens and occasionally featured RSI team members as guests. Though the game itself is long delayed, fans like Nekara are deeply involved in its development. He tells us about RSI's public test universe, where every day backers are helping them test the game, refine it, fix bugs, and find bugs, actually more often. It's a very collaborative effort to build the game, and that's the feeling that you get. This is my project too, you know? Nekara sees his role in Star Citizen as making a small contribution to an epic project. You're going to build this thing that has never been built before. No one's ever conceived of building something like this before, but you get to put in 3 bricks into that wall. The only reason it stands is because you contributed. That is sort of the feeling that you get. Nekara has added a lot more than 3 bricks. He has spent around $2,075. He owns 6 ships, has brought at least 10 friends into the game, and has bought t-shirts and hoodies. He especially enjoys giving ships as gifts to other players and bringing new people into the community. He calculates his spending on Star Citizen at about $35 a month, less than the $85 a month he spends on his cell phone. At the time of writing, over 4 years since the crowdfunding began, and with over $150 million raised, the epic universe that Star Citizen promised is still being built. Roberts continues to rally his crowd, keeping their dreams alive. Every day we get closer to our shared dream of a living, breathing, science fiction universe where we can immerse ourselves like never before. Many will see this as a con, and it might well prove to be. But there is another way of thinking about Star Citizen. Fans like Nekara have already seen real returns on their investments, paid to them in the currency of community ties and opportunities to contribute and imagine. Herein may lie the biggest irony of all. The original universe that the fans purchased from RSI, should it ever arrive, will likely never be as immersive, rich, or dynamic as the universe they have already created together. Chapter 8. Taking the turn from old to new power. A very British crowdjacking. The Lost Voyage of Boaty McBoatface. At 2:30 p.m. on Tuesday, May 10th, 2016, in the Wilson Room of the Houses of Parliament, a formal inquiry began into what on earth had just happened to one of Britain's ships. The chair opened proceedings by asking Professor Duncan Wingham, Chief Executive of the Natural Environment Research Council, NERC, a question about his boss. "Do you think that the minister is proud, or do you think he is going to make you walk the plank?" To his great credit, and with a level of bombast that was more Donald Trump than British bureaucrat, Wingham declared that the project under inquiry had delivered an astonishingly great outcome, and that his organization had just become probably the best-known research council in the world. Though it would end with a parliamentary inquiry, the story of this renegade ship began without much drama or expectation. NERC is a fairly dusty, independent agency of the UK government. It is the leading public funder of environmental science, supporting research, universities and more. It makes grants, it funds research reports, it tackles complex scientific issues. But in early 2016, it was getting very excited about plans for a new $300 million polar research vessel that was to be the UK's largest and most advanced research ship yet and would launch in 2019. To engage the public in this big moment, NERC created a campaign called #NameOurShip, allowing the public to suggest and then vote on the appropriate name for this new vessel. As Professor Wingham said at the time, "We're excited to hear what the public have to suggest, and we really are open to ideas." NERC's press release trailed the sober and august names that had already been submitted: Endeavour, Shackleton, Falcon. And then the voting was opened up for a month. The contest, an earnest and fairly vanilla new power experiment by an old power government agency, soon caught the attention of James Hand, a former BBC presenter. He was not especially moved by names like Endeavour, but was drawn to the more whimsical entries that were popping up. So he typed in Boaty McBoatface. He then filled the description field, where he was supposed to justify his entry with the simple logic that it's an absolutely brilliant name. The internet, of course, agreed. Boaty immediately attracted tens of thousands of votes. The NERC website crashed from all the enthusiasm. 3 days after the contest launch, Hand tweeted out a very British apology. "I'm terribly sorry about all of this, @NERC Science. But this was only the beginning. Soon stories started to appear in the UK news media about the renegade success of the little boat that could, and the large government agency having to deal with the growing wave of social media support lifting up Boaty. This caught the interest of the global media, with NPR, The New York Times and CNN joining the flotilla. Boaty had become an icon, with the story playing out in the headlines, on TV shows, in pubs and at dinner tables across the United Kingdom. It had become a cultural moment, at once a celebration of the British sense of humour and a modern parable of crowds versus castles. In a fine example of storm chasing, James Hand was approached by the cruise giant Royal Caribbean International and asked to offer his expert ship-naming skills to launch its next vessel. As President and CEO Michael Bailey said, "The people of the United Kingdom know the name of a great ship when they see it." Boaty was everywhere. The campaign reached 250 million people online. The #NameOurShip hashtag was used 23 million times on Twitter. The website generated 2.3 million page views. Of course, Boaty won the vote by a landslide, attracting 124,000 votes and finishing well ahead of other top 10 entries, which included the noteworthy "I like big boats and I cannot lie," "RRS, it's bloody cold here," and "Boatimus Prime." The whole venture had been what we call crowd-jacked, separated from its original intent through the whimsy of the crowd. Yet not everyone found this funny. Science Minister Joe Johnson, it was reported in The Guardian, said as the vote closed, "We want a name that lasts longer than a social media news cycle." Rumblings grew that Wingham would exercise his right to overrule the crowd and make the final call. So it was that on Friday, May 6th, Boaty McBoatface was buried at sea. In a clever and somewhat cynical move, NERC declared it would name the ship after the great naturalist, TV presenter, and ageing national treasure, Sir David Attenborough. A choice no one could really complain about. To soften the blow further, it claimed that the people's boat would live on in the form of one of the ship's remotely operated subsea vessels, which would be named Boaty McBoatface. The parliamentary inquiry that followed was partly a slap on the wrist for NERC for all the brouhaha, but also a real discussion, in the scientific tradition, of what might be learned from this viral drama. To provide some insight, Nurk brought along an expert witness, Professor James Wilsdon, a social scientist from the University of Sheffield. He gamely defended Nurk's Attenborough gambit as a very elegant compromise, but then managed to tip the room into hysterics when he admitted that he too had voted for Boaty McBoatface. Once order was restored, Wilsdon clarified that he didn't believe that a question like hashtag name our ship was the right approach for scientific engagement of the public. He pointed out that if you ask superficial, low-stakes questions, you'll get a different response than you might on weightier topics. Under pressure, Wingham conceded that Nurk had not had much of a plan for follow-up or future engagement, admitting that we're only really now beginning to address those longer-term questions and sustain that level of interest. Even when thrown a softball question by the chair about whether Nurk had thought about creating lesson plans around Boaty for teachers, Wingham, a little snootily, suggested that the primary role of a research council is to work at a higher level. One could conclude from Wingham's testimony that Nurk didn't have an entirely sincere interest in the crowd's opinion. It liked the idea of the public suggesting something, as long as the something was suitably august. It didn't have any kind of trusted community it could count on to participate earnestly. Nor did it have a long-term, or even a short-term, plan to meaningfully engage the crowd it attracted. And as soon as the naming project started going in a direction the executives didn't like, they defaulted to old power and imposed the outcome they wanted. At the parliamentary inquiry, those overseeing matters suggested that the internet was trivialising science. But in this case, it is fairer to say that science trivialised the internet. Nurk didn't fundamentally need the crowd's help, and it wasn't prepared for the consequences of unleashing its energy and sense of fun. This is a forgivable sin. Many old power organisations are making steps and missteps like this as they tentatively move into a new power world. But Nurk's unforgivable sin was in abandoning Boaty at precisely the moment it should have embraced her. The agency had attracted hundreds of thousands of people, and much of the mainstream media, all of whom now had a vested interest in Boaty. Had it leaned in to all that engagement and proudly smashed the champagne bottle on the hull of Boaty McBoatface, it could have built a community that would have delivered for Nurk for years. You might imagine a generation of Brits following Boaty's adventures by GPS, school kids greeting Boaty when she docked in their town. You could imagine t-shirts, mugs, avatars, video games, cartoons. Boaty might have become the most participatory vessel in the world, capable of delighting the public, but also of providing a portal for more substantial engagement with the scientific inquiry she pursued. A hint of what Nurk gave up came in the 2017 spike of press and engagement it got around the first research voyage of the subsea vessel version of Boaty, which was ready for the water before the actual ship itself. Nurk had an admirable impulse when it began this misadventure. Like many old power organisations, it sensed a need to engage with a bigger community and open up to the world. But also, like many old power organisations, it didn't go about this in quite the right way. For old power organisations wishing to move into the new power world beyond the occasional initiative or stunt, there are four fundamental issues to consider as they set out to take the turn, as shown in the decision tree we will refer to shortly. Imagine if Nurk had asked itself these questions in deciding when and how to turn to new power. Decision tree. When and whether to turn to new power. Strategy. Do you need the involvement of the crowd to get a better outcome? Does the crowd need you? No? Stick with old power. Yes? Consider new power. Legitimacy. Do you have enough legitimacy with the people you're trying to engage so that you're not ignored or crowd-jacked? No? Stick with old power. Yes? Consider new power. Control. Are you willing to cede some control to the crowd within parameters you set and accept outcomes that are unexpected or suboptimal? No? Stick with old power. Yes? Consider new power. Commitment. Are you prepared and able to sustain the engagement of the crowd and feed their agency over the longer term? No? Stick with old power. Yes? Use new power. Strategy. The first question to consider is whether new power really fits with your strategy. What problem are you trying to solve that your old power repertoire can't handle? What opportunity exists in the energy of the crowd that could add real value for your efforts? What new innovations might come from the crowd that would not have come from inside your walls? In Nurk's case, it wasn't clear that it really needed or wanted the crowd to name its boat, given that executives were set on a conventional choice. But part of this equation, too, is the question of what value you can deliver to your crowd. The crowd cannot be seen as an asset to be strip-mined. Any new power strategy needs to consider what's really in it for the people you want to engage with. Legitimacy. If engaging new power makes strategic sense, the next question is whether you already have, or are prepared to build, trust and credibility in the space you want to engage. This means there are specific communities that you're confident will show up for you. This requires more than simply having the CEO join Twitter. When in 2013, JP Morgan, with wounds from the financial crisis still fresh, launched #AskJPM, a Twitter campaign offering career advice to aspiring professionals, its lack of legitimacy was flung back in its face. Its efforts were quickly dispatched by a bemused crowd with questions like, "Did you always want to be part of a vast corrupt criminal enterprise, or did you break bad?" One of Nurk's challenges was that it didn't have a bought-in existing crowd to draw on, nor did it do much to engage the people it was meeting for the first time. Its approach was to lower the drawbridge and trumpet openness, but it didn't have an existing core of supporters who might have tried to redirect the boaty crowd-jacking. Control. Meaningfully incorporating new power and getting something meaningful out of the result requires a willingness to give up at least some control and accept a range of outcomes, including an answer you might not view as ideal. Otherwise, you'll never really unleash people's energy and enthusiasm. This does not mean an organization has to embrace anarchy, but it does mean that once you have carefully structured the ways your communities can engage, you need to be prepared to be surprised if they lead you in an unexpected direction. Had Nurk been willing to give up some measure of control, it might have seen the big opportunity that fell into its lap when Boaty took off, but instead it chose to put the genie back in the bottle. Commitment. Too often, old power organizations see new power as an occasional, peripheral, and intermittent activity. But getting the best results requires a willingness to cultivate the energy and enthusiasms of a community of people over an extended period, which Nurk had no plan or intention to do. If new power enthusiasm is simply a flavor of the month, or the passion project of an unsupported mid-level millennial, it is much less likely to succeed. As any seasoned movement builder can tell you, the greatest viral successes and most impactful moments usually come after months and years of consistent investment in your crowd. If Nurk had thought through the decision tree questions, it might have chosen to engage a more specific community of people, perhaps engineers or shipping enthusiasts, on a more substantive question than boat naming. Or it might have made the decision to wait and build a stronger new power base before going retail. Or it might have chosen to go ahead with eyes wide open, ready for something unexpected to happen, and to embrace the storm that ensued. When organizations confront the big questions posed by the decision tree, and make the decision to take the turn, there can be significant upside. The turnaround of the Lego company is a remarkable example of how, with a lot of work and sustained commitment, an old power organization can embrace new power and thrive. How Lego saved its company by embracing new power. A new millennium was beginning, but the Lego company was crumbling. The 70-year-old Danish firm had focused too much on its theme parks. It had created a vast number of products, many more than the market would bear. It had lost its connection with its consumers. It was suffering from sales decline and a culture of top-down management. In 2003, it posted its biggest loss ever. Enter Jorgen Vig Nudstorp, who in 2004 became CEO, the first non-family leader of the family firm. He carried out many of the typical turnaround CEO tasks. Cut staff, reduced the number of products by half, sold off peripheral businesses, and refocused the company. Out were the wristwatches, in were the bricks. Nudstorp represented a big shift in business strategy, but he was closely aligned with the owner and chairman, Kjeld Kirk Christiansen, who played a key cultural and symbolic role within the company. In an attempt to understand the Lego business better, Nudstorp, often accompanied by Christiansen, began to attend the fan-organized Lego events that had multiplied across the country. He recalled how important his visit to one such event, Brickfest 2005, had proved. "I came with my family, so it was a really nice event. I gave a talk for half an hour with no slides. Afterwards, I spent 2 hours with the fans on Q&A from the stage. It was my breakthrough because I established a personal relationship with them. During the rest of the weekend, they came over and talked, took care of my kids." What he saw in the crowd was great passion and also great commercial potential. The Lego brand had always been well-loved, of course, but the growth of the internet was allowing more dynamic forms of appreciation for the product. People weren't just getting together at conferences like Brickfest. Fan clubs were beginning to pop up across the world. And nascent online communities were emerging too. Take MOC Pages, now one of the largest online Lego fan communities in the world, which was launched by a single Lego fan, Sean Kenny. When Kenny launched his site, he had been surprised and inspired to see that visitors from around the world were leaving messages, rating his creations and sharing their ideas. He witnessed, before the Lego people did, the surging demand among makers to share, connect, and build on one another's creations. MOC stands for My Own Creation. Today it is a platform for over 500,000 fan-made designs using Lego sets. As it tried to dig its way out of crisis, Lego's leadership was sensing a big opportunity in this deeply committed and increasingly networked consumer base. But to uncover it, they needed to engage with a group of customers they had historically ignored. For the first time in their history, the Lego group decided to get serious about the AFOLs. Meet the AFOLs. Robin Sather has not gone through a single birthday or Christmas without receiving a gift of Lego. He is in his 50s and remembers getting his first Lego set when he was 4. He still has some of those bricks. As he got older, his love for Lego toys never faded. But this was a source of discomfort rather than pride. Before the internet came along, he thought he was the only adult that was still into Lego. He wasn't. Individuals all over the world had kept on building into their adulthoods, but they just hadn't found one another. "We all thought we were freaks and all alone and did it in secret," said Robin. The rise of the internet saw a global network of people like Robin stepping out of the closet, or more often the garage. "We all discovered each other. As with many things, a lot of Lego enthusiasts started to form clubs, and a community happened." No longer a furtive solo builder, Sather became a proud co-founder of the Vancouver Lego Club. He also took on a new badge of honour. He became an AFOL. An AFOL is an adult fan of Lego. Someone like Robin, who loved Lego sets as a kid and then kept up with their interest in later life. In Brick by Brick, David Robertson and Bill Breen reported that this was a group that the Lego company had historically neglected. They were seen as few in number and not worth listening to. Some saw them in less flattering terms than that. And even those middle managers who saw potential in adult fans were usually rebuffed by leadership. Yet under Nudstorp and Christiansen's new direction, things started to change, and for good reason. Even though AFOLs were only 5% of the total market at this point, they were outspending the average family with kids 20 to 1. They were responsible for another phenomenon too. AFOLs would often turn up at a Lego fair, build something amazing, and then 2,500 kids and families would show up. So would local media. In our new power terms, the AFOLs were the Lego company's super participants. Invested, passionate organizers, they were capable of generating communities of their own around the Lego brand. Sure, the company's core participants remained the kids, but increasingly LEGO's executives would see its economic value and its community culture as shaped by AFOLs. The LEGO Group's big pivot was to stop treating AFOLs as an underclass of nobodies or a den of weirdos, and start building structures to respect them, engage them as super participants, and channel their value for the LEGO ecosystem. Opening up the castle. At the heart of this effort was senior director Tormod Askildsen. He hired the company's first community manager, began to engage seriously with the LEGO super users, and started to identify smart ways to connect the company with its crowd. This paid off quickly and unexpectedly. One super user, John Barnes, was an expert in making high-tech sensors. Working with Barnes's firm, the LEGO Group made big improvements to their new robotics kit. Another, Adam Reed Tucker, founder of Brick World Chicago, now one of the largest fan events, and a self-described guy with an idea, had become passionate about building highly detailed recreations of great buildings using LEGO materials, notably attracting interest and press around his Chicago Sears Tower. Previously, mid-level LEGO managers had been serving as AFOL dealers, feeding him bricks to fund his habit, but now senior management engaged. This partnership developed into the hugely popular LEGO Architecture line, which has created sets for AFOLs to build the world's greatest buildings. From the Sydney Opera House, to Falling Water, to the Burj Khalifa. Part of Askildsen's success was his openness to ideas from the outside. Robin Sather remembers putting together a white paper for LEGO that proposed the creation of a formal ambassador network and recognized status for the most talented builders. LEGO Ambassador Network now has a full-time staff and an online platform dedicated to supporting and connecting the leaders of hundreds of local user groups from Hawaii to the Philippines to Jakarta. In effect, this is a sophisticated community of LEGO super participants who work to grow events, develop ideas, and test new markets for the firm. In return, the LEGO company provides free kits, funding, marketing support, and perhaps most of all, a communal identity and legitimacy for its unpaid leaders. The crowd makes the kits. The crowd makes the movies. The LEGO Ideas platform took engagement with AFOLs even further, bringing to the mainstream an idea that grew from a pilot project from LEGO Japan. Put simply, it crowdsources the creation of the next LEGO models. So if you are a fan with an idea for a new set, you can submit your plans to be assessed by the LEGO community. If 10,000 participants vote to get behind your idea, LEGO administrators take it to a formal review. The very best ideas turn into new products. With three seasons each year, LEGO Ideas is like American Idol for AFOLs. Over a dozen sets have now made their way from the crowd to the shelves. Those whose LEGO Ideas get to market don't just get glory. They share in the value creation, earning 1% of sales revenues. One winner was Dr. Ellen Quoiman, online alias Alatariel, a geochemist who had never before shared any of her LEGO creations with anyone other than her husband. She was frustrated that female LEGO figures were in the minority and fell into stereotypical roles. The LEGO Group suffers from a heavily male bias in both its fan base and its corporate culture. As a scientist herself, she saw the need for professional female minifigures that also show that girls can become anything they want, including a paleontologist or an astronomer. Women, scientists, and AFOLs everywhere agreed. After years of cultivation, the LEGO community is now a critical piece of business infrastructure, as important to the company as its factories or intellectual property, something that it can count on in large and small ways. The base was critical to the success of the LEGO Movie in 2014, which was a huge hit, bringing in almost $500 million in worldwide box office returns. When Twitter user @shiz_knit asked, "Is there anyone out there who is super excited about the LEGO Movie and is older than 32 so I can feel slightly better about myself?" LEGO staff knew exactly how to respond, replying, "Age is just a number," and encouraging this AFOL to join community engagement efforts around the film. In fact, AFOLs were active in both the development and promotion of the Lego movie. The film's creators invited the Lego community to film and submit their own scenes, and several fan creations actually landed in the final cut. Looking back on a decade of change, Robin Sather, now one of just over a dozen Lego certified professionals, the company's most prestigious title for expert builders, puts a nice wrapper on things. The Lego company was like Willy Wonka's chocolate factory. It was this massive edifice where delicious, wonderful things came out the front door, but you never really knew how. You had no access inside. You didn't really know where they came from. You didn't know how it all worked. As the internet flourished and a bunch of different things happened, the doors gradually opened up and we began to see inside. The whole renaissance of the Lego company opening itself up to the community and to the world has been amazing, and it just continues to evolve. The Lego company was able to say yes to each of the questions in the decision tree, giving us a good sense of why its turn to new power was so successful. The Lego group built a strategy in which cultivating its new power community was key to reviving its core business. This wasn't just window dressing or pandering. The company's connection with the AFOLs and its wider communities acted as an incredible and incredibly inexpensive compared to traditional broadcast advertising efforts marketing machine. Just glance at how many fan-created Lego YouTube videos there are. The crowd also provides it a huge expert innovation resource at very little cost. As Nudstorp has noted, new products deliver 60% of total Lego sales each year. Executives also had a clear sense of what they could do for the crowd. Yunmi Antorini, the Lego Community Engagement Director of Innovation and Development and an academic who has studied the Lego group over the years, sums up the company's philosophy toward the crowd. You're crashing someone else's party. What can you bring to the party? By putting community management at the center of their business and investing in carefully structured incentives to participate, Lego leadership made being an AFOL more rewarding and meaningful. Lego staff also worked hard to develop legitimacy with the crowd. The early efforts of both its owner and its CEO to engage with their previously neglected communities created the right signal. They earned legitimacy with the AFOLs by legitimizing them, taking them out of their AFOL closets and putting them at the center of the company's culture and innovation engine. This offers a key lesson. If you want to be taken seriously by your crowd, taking them seriously is a good place to start. When it came to thinking about control, Lego had something of an advantage. The core design of their product relied on their consumers shaping the product. As Antorini put it, the Lego group could never, can never, and should never, as to this day, really influence what users are doing with the product. But leadership should still be credited with an essential insight that by relinquishing control even further, they would uncover value. By providing smart routes for participation, Lego staff was able to guide its crowd in certain directions, but without insisting on outcomes. The surge of support behind Alitariel's female scientist Lego figures is a good example of how the crowd course-corrected the company, which had neglected to meet this need. All this progress required a long-term commitment from Lego. It went through an evolution over a decade, not a revolution over a season, with a steady stream of initiatives and experiments that shifted the structure and culture of its business and its communities. As Antorini told us, this has not been easy. Talking about win-win models is easy to do, but striking the right balance between crowd and company is hard work to make it work on both sides. This commitment came from the very top of the institution and has never been a stunt. This thoughtful and deliberate approach delivered 10 consecutive years of organic growth and a renewed dominance in its sector. By 2015, Lego had surpassed Mattel as the world's largest toy company and was anointed world's most powerful brand by a leading brand strategy consultancy, not least because of the deep passion of its community. Building a new power team. At the Lego Group, taking the turn to new power required more than the leadership of CEO Nudstorp. Its family owner, Kjeld Kirk Christiansen, its chief change agent, Tormod Askildsen, and its community managers and key AFOLs like Robin Sather and Dr. Ellen Koyman all played distinct roles and worked together to pull off its transformation. And that is true more broadly. As organisations take the turn, four important characters tend to emerge. Here are the four, alongside four false prophets who are often confused with them. New power team, the shapeshifter. False prophet, the disruptor. New power team, the bridge. False prophet, the digital beard. New power team, the solution seeker. False prophet, the problem solver. New power team, the super participant. False prophet, the stakeholder. The shapeshifter versus the disruptor. The shapeshifter is a new power change agent in old power garb, a figure with unimpeachable institutional credibility who smooths the path to change and sets an example for the timid or resistant to follow. The shapeshifter figure will likely not be the person who executes day-to-day the big structural changes that make transitions happen, but will be the spiritual and symbolic figure who, steeped in tradition, is ideally placed to guide the institution toward a new identity and a new relationship with its communities. At the Lego Group, the role of shapeshifter was deftly played by family owner Kjeld Kirk Christiansen, whose enthusiasm for engaging with the crowd was a critical signal to the organisation that this new innovation was not a dereliction of Lego history or tradition, but a powerful validation of its new power community. His close alliance with CEO Nudstorp offered the right symbolic support for what became a huge shift in culture. Another example of the shapeshifter, as we will see in the next chapter, is Pope Francis, who has used his infallible old power credibility to unleash unexpected change. Contrast the shapeshifter with a much more familiar modern figure in organisations, the disruptor. The rallying cry of this generation has in many ways been disrupt, with traditional institutions being quickly classified as dinosaurs and earnestly instructed in the ways of the future by those with slick spectacles and thin resumes. When former Yahoo executive Guy Vidra was brought in to run The New Republic, a venerable old power public interest magazine that wanted to transition into the digital era, he delivered a notoriously off-key speech to the magazine's writers and editors, as recounted by The New Yorker. "They say that there's two types of CEOs," he said. "There's the peacetime CEO and the wartime CEO. Not to be overly dramatic about it, but this is sort of a war. This is a wartime period. That just means that we need to change a lot of things. We need to just break shit. And it's scary. It's definitely a scary thing to do. But it's also fun. You know, lean up against the wall and break it." Not long after, the editor-in-chief and most of the magazine's staff resigned in protest. Leading an old power organisation through transition isn't about breaking shit. It requires a tricky blend of tradition and innovation, past and future. Those efforts need shapeshifters who can show, by example, how to get the best of both worlds. The bridge versus the digital beard. More than one old power organisation has found itself with a chief innovation officer or director of strategic initiatives parachuted in by a CEO desperate to uncover some magical revenue line or to serve as public evidence that her leadership really is engaging with the new world. But despite good intentions, these people often end up as digital beards, providing cover for a risk-averse leader and an unchanging strategy, and relegated to the margins of power and influence within the organisation. They are often a small department paid to think about the future, resented by the rest of the organisation for not doing what is considered real work. They cut ribbons at openings for 3D printing labs, but in reality are often siloed and underfunded. Instead of the beard, what organisations really need is a bridge. That person who can meaningfully connect his organisation to the new power world, making the practical jumps between old and new power. A bridge's work is structural, above all. At the Lego Group, that bridge figure was Senior Director Tormod Askildsen. It was Askildsen who had conducted the earliest new power experiments there and was tapped by the CEO when the company was ready to make a bigger shift. He was effective at navigating internal systems and culture, painstakingly built up community management at LEGO from one lonely hire to a whole function in the organisation, and worked to integrate his team and the wider community they represented with the product designers, marketers and other incumbents. To show a bridge at work, meet Helen Bevan, a changemaker living inside one of the world's most quintessential old power systems. The National Health Service, the UK's publicly funded healthcare system, known by all as the NHS, has more than 1.5 million employees. Only four organisations in the world are larger: McDonald's, Walmart, the People's Liberation Army of China, and the US Defence Department. For more than 25 years, Helen Bevan has worked as an internal change agent, looking to tame this much-loved but often maligned bureaucratic beast. Her role has been to find smart ways to make things better, from reducing waiting times for patients to improving cancer care. She describes the NHS as two old power systems inside each other. First, you have an organizing model that is very command-driven and top-down. Then you have the clinical hierarchy with doctors at the top and patients at the base. As her career progressed in the 1990s and 2000s, the NHS was shaped by its efforts to meet big and demanding national targets. Targets for waiting times. Targets for what happened to people who had a stroke. The targets were crude tools, but they had real value. They ushered in a more accountable culture and delivered some tangible improvements. Yet they often came at a cost. Achieving them frequently had a negative impact on staff morale and patient care. For many, the culture of targets was a culture of fear, governed by anxious higher-ups. More and more, Bevan felt the NHS was hitting the target, but missing the point. One of her signature achievements is the School for Health and Care Radicals, which has been recently renamed the School for Change Agents. This pop-up school rallies and connects the community she sees as key to transforming the NHS. Heretics and innovators who can bring new ideas to the system. The school operates primarily as a 5-week MOOC, massive open online course, but has broadened to include online discussions, mentoring, and in-person activities for those taking part. It is free and open not just to NHS employees, but to anyone in the world. Thousands of people participate in the school, whose benefits range from offering peer support to the colleague on the verge of leaving, to giving a big boost to the wannabe changemaker who now feels, "This has given me the permission to actually say, yes, go ahead and do it." The school brings together much of the thinking that Bevan has championed in recent years. In 2013, she and a young clinician dreamed up NHS Change Day, a grassroots effort to mobilise people throughout the NHS system to pledge one thing they might do to improve life for patients. It offered a lot of freedom and few conditions or rules, encouraging people to choose just one commitment they might make on the same day as their colleagues. It came at a time that the NHS was feeling especially strained, with increasing demands and diminishing funding. Change Day was a classic ACE campaign, with a clear call to action that connected staff around an inspiring goal and an extensible frame that participants could make their own. Nurses in the city of York pledged to create a mock ward where they would play the role of patients in an effort to increase empathy. In Leicester, they cleared out old paperwork, dispensing with 200 boxes of unnecessary literature. In East Cheshire, staff set up a weekly ritual where they would come together to ask, "What have I done to help a patient this week?" guarding against the danger of getting stuck in administrative work rather than engaging with patients. Many people pledged to smile at colleagues and patients more. Doctors pledged to taste the paediatric medications they dispense. Teams hit the streets to engage with the public to ask their opinion on how the NHS might improve. In all, in its first year, Change Day generated 189,000 pledges. By year two, there were over 800,000. It was the first major grassroots mobilisation inside the system, unleashing the vast agency of frontline staff. As Robert Ferris Rogers, Director of Engagement for a large NHS region, put it, "Change Day fundamentally changed the way I thought about engagement and connection. It was phenomenal to be part of it, and the power that was created by commitment rather than compliance. The even more inspiring element of this was that it was undertaken in one of the most hierarchical organizations in the world. The breaking down of barriers and liberating staff to make a difference was brilliant, and I know it made a difference to people's lives, both staff and patients. Bevan's team also catalyzed a fresh approach to treating people with dementia, an arena where very powerful antipsychotic drugs were being prescribed to people living with dementia to subdue them and keep them quiet. These drugs had harsh potential consequences, leading to strokes and even death. As Bevan notes, the typical old power approach to a challenge like this would be somebody at the center, at the top of the system, would say, "We are going to create a new standard, and we are going to instruct doctors not to give these drugs to patients, and we are going to instruct pharmacists to make sure the doctors don't give the drugs to the patients." She had seen many times the failings of relying on a top-down system alone. Working with a national charity called the Dementia Action Alliance, Bevan's team used movement-building tactics to start a national effort around the issue, bringing in doctors, pharmacists, nursing home staff, caregivers, and a constellation of other actors. It was classic new power, in Bevan's words, with lots of different communities and groups all doing their own thing. Together, in less than 3 years, they delivered a 51% reduction in prescribing antipsychotics to people with dementia. With efforts like the School for Health and Care Radicals, Change Day, and the Dementia Initiative, Bevan is trying to channel the energy that clearly exists inside her system and turn it from occasional stunt to a cultural norm. Her aim is to create a community of change agents who operate in what she calls the zigzaggy place between old and new power. These people are not necessarily linked by their positions, nor by their specialties, but by a genuine interest in mobilizing their communities to affect better health outcomes. Bevan is the perfect example of a bridge to new power. Incumbents, whether individuals or long-time institutions, are often ready to roll their eyes at the efforts of bridges like Helen Bevan. The price of occasional public failure can seem higher than quietly managing decline. Yet they are essential figures in organizations wishing to transform. The solution seeker versus the problem solver. Back in chapter 2, we told the story of NASA's experiment with open innovation, all the opportunities it unleashed and all the troubles it caused. You might remember that the scientists and researchers divided into two groups, one that resisted engaging with the crowd, one that embraced it. As NASA's experiment with open innovation unfolded, its scientists developed an internal vocabulary to describe the difference between fiercely divided camps, problem solvers and solution seekers. Their archetypes will ring a bell for many when they think about their own workplaces and teams. The problem solvers were those who resisted change. Their identity was invested in their own expertise. They were scientists in the tradition of Galileo, those whose individual genius would light the way. The solution seekers got their name from a heated debate that Hilla Lifshitz Asaf observed, where a highly respected scientist rebuked reluctant colleagues. "Your main responsibility is to seek for solutions, and they may come from the lab, from open innovation, or from collaboration. You should not care. You are the solution seeker." It was this group of scientists that got creative and serious about the wider community. They shifted the boundaries of their worlds to invite people in. For this group, success wasn't that you personally had the answer, but that you were open to experiment, ready to find answers in unexpected places and from unexpected people. Any team taking the turn needs to build a squad of solution seekers. These are the people typically drawn from the main body of staff who will become the experimenters and allies of new power initiatives. Investing in this group and recruiting for it is key, not just in creating new value for an enterprise, but as a political force. In old power organizations, all of our resources, training, recognition, and rewards are geared to problem solving. Shifting them is hard work. At NASA, it was the smart work of Jeffrey Davis and his team in their bridge role that encouraged people inclined to be solution seekers. They provided a path for those who were prepared to become a new kind of expert, secure and self-confident enough in their abilities to look outward. They did this with an opt-in approach, creating frequent lunch events, sessions with outside speakers, and opportunities for the curious to find out more. Then, as soon as interest started to build and results started to be generated, the team of administrators got themselves out of the picture. They made sure it was the solution seekers rather than the staff overseeing the initiative who became the stars of the show. These stars recruited others, and the cultural shift really began to take root. The super participant versus the stakeholder. No new power team would be complete, of course, without those people who create huge value in the community, the super participants. These are the most engaged and active people in your wider crowd. AFOLs like Robin Sather, who set up the Vancouver Lego Club, and Bruce Cragin, the semi-retired telecommunications engineer who outthought a group of the best-resourced rocket scientists in the world. Though his idea was the most celebrated, he was just one of many super participants who contributed valuable thinking to NASA's efforts. One of the dangers of transitioning to new power is in seeing the crowd as a distant, amorphous asset, a blurry mass of occasional opportunity. But crowds cannot be approached in the same way that organizations often treat such stakeholders as civil society or investors. As external actors who must be managed and sometimes tolerated, alongside the pursuit of the activities that really matter. In contrast, super participants always participate, and they create value by doing so. A company like Lego has developed such a valuable community of super participants because it has been prepared to genuinely embrace the world outside its four walls and beyond its payroll. Unlike NERC, which dipped its toe into new power waters and retreated at the first sign of a wave, the organizations who get this right are those who dive deep. Chapter 9. Leadership. Thank you for everything. My last ask is the same as my first. I'm asking you to believe, not in my ability to create change, but in yours. Barack Obama, January 2017. I alone can fix it. Donald Trump, Republican National Convention, July 2016. How do we make sense of leadership when the world's leading democracy can elect Barack Obama and then replace him with Donald Trump? How do we reconcile a world of ever-proliferating leaderless movements like Occupy Wall Street and the Arab Spring, but also ever-proliferating strongmen like Russia's Putin, Turkey's Erdogan, and Egypt's El-Sisi? This chapter is about leadership in a world of colliding and overlapping old and new power forces. It's about the ways new power tools are unexpectedly being used to strengthen and reinforce leaders with deeply old power values. And it is about emerging forms of leadership that aspire to bring together new power tools and new power values in order to meaningfully redistribute power. To start to make sense of it all, let's take the new power compass from Chapter 2 and apply it to how people lead. If we map out both the values and leadership models people are using, we can draw four different leadership archetypes. You will recognize some of these in the news and in your own world. First quadrant, new power model, new power values, crowd leaders. Second quadrant, old power model, new power values, cheerleaders. Third quadrant, old power model, old power values, castles. Fourth quadrant, new power model, old power values, co-opters. The crowd leader, first quadrant, combines a new power leadership model with a commitment to and articulation of new power values. The crowd leader wants to do more than channel the power of her crowd. She wants to make her crowd more powerful. The cheerleader, second quadrant, champions new power values like collaboration, transparency, and participation, but leads in an old power way. He either isn't able or doesn't want to genuinely distribute power. The castle, third quadrant, pairs old power values with an old power leadership model. This is the traditional hierarchical and authority-based model of leadership most of us grew up with, and which is widespread in sectors like the military, business, and education. The co-opter, fourth quadrant. Deploys a crowd and skillfully uses new power tools and tactics, but does so in the service of old power values.